Chapter 7. Attack. Robert H. Morris's phone at the NSA did not stop ringing on the morning of the 3rd of November 1988. Morris was chief scientist at the agency's National Computer Security Center, NCSC, and with his long, scraggly beard, a man who seemed to blend the past and present, every inch the brilliant eccentric, equally at home poking holes in a computer system or building a sheep pen in his back garden based on designs from medieval manuscripts. The three chalkboards in his office were filled with what he told visitors were Russian riddles and mathematical equations, but he also had a Dockmaster computer terminal, the first, and at that time the only, NSA system which connected to the outside world. It was used to share unclassified computer security information with contractors and gave the NSA user a most unusual thing, a public email address and an insight into the early Internet. Morris logged on to Dockmaster at 6:30 a.m. that November morning as it became clear something bad was happening online. At 6:45 a.m., he received the first call. It came from Cliff Stoll, a computer expert cum sleuth at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in California. "Hi, Bob," said Stoll. "We've got troubles." Stoll had no idea how true that was for Morris. A few hours earlier, Stoll had been woken by a phone call. His glow-in-the-dark alarm clock told him it was the inhuman hour of 2:25 a.m. A friend from a NASA computer lab was on the other end of the line. "No apologies for waking you up," the friend said excitedly. "Our computers are under attack." Stoll stumbled over to his Macintosh, but it didn't start. After 5 minutes, still nothing. When eventually he connected to a bulletin board, he found a message from another Berkeley user that had just been posted. It read, "We are under attack." The Internet was going down. In the tight confines of the community, there was blind panic. All across America, machines were grinding to a halt, sometimes slowing down and stumbling like late-night drunks, sometimes falling over entirely, crashing to the ground in a catatonic state. This was only happening to machines connected to the Internet, and it seemed to be spreading. This suggested that something was traveling through the Internet itself and infecting the machines it came across. The small group of computer experts would never forget the next few days and the lesson they taught about the vulnerability of the computer systems on which they depended. It was called a worm, although some thought virus was a better description. The difference is based on the biological analogy that a virus works by infecting a host, whether a person or a computer program, while a worm lives and replicates by itself. Whatever name people preferred, it had been unleashed at 5 p.m. on America's East Coast the evening before Stoll's call to Morris. It took an hour to infect its first machine, but then it picked up pace. Half an hour later, it hit the RAND Corporation, which carried out defense research for the government. By 9 p.m., it had headed over to the West Coast and Stanford. The Internet had been designed so that responsibility for securing computers was devolved to each host or institution, like a university. The result was that no one was in charge. By 11:45 p.m., the Army Ballistics Research Laboratory was hit. Fearing an attack by some kind of unknown enemy, it cut itself off from the Internet. No one knew where the worm was coming from or what it was doing to their systems other than slowing them down. Was it destroying data or stealing it? Would their machines ever work again? It was utter confusion. Just after midnight, Princeton University's main computer crashed. Just after 1 a.m., Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory was struck. Desperate researchers began capturing the worm and dissecting its code to understand what it was doing. By 11:30 in the morning, the U.S. military closed down any links between its own internal MILNET system and the ARPANET to prevent cross-infection. It was an epidemic. The handwritten operations logs by the desperate computer staff trying to respond reveal, minute by minute, the frantic attempts to control the spread, shutting Cray supercomputers on and off, disconnecting terminals from the network and searching through code. Working through the night, some had figured out ways to stop the spread and were sending instructions. But these messages were themselves becoming clogged in the system and not getting through. In all, 6,000 machines had been infected. This may not sound a lot, but in 1988, the entire Internet consisted only of 60,000 connected machines, up from 25 machines on ARPANET in 1973. There was a simple equation here. The easier you made it for machines to talk to each other, the easier you made it for something bad to spread among them. Britain was barely touched by the event, since it had very limited connections with the US ARPANET. A network had been constructed to share, but sharing meant sharing whatever bad things got into the system. All of this meant that 1/10 of the entire Internet had been taken down in hours. "Whoever wrote the virus must be laughing, but it's going to mean a rough day for everyone," Stoll told Morris on the phone that morning. "Any ideas who started it?" Morris asked. "Nope," replied Stoll. "Don't worry about it. I'll look into it and see what I can do," replied Morris. The call ended, and Stoll stared back at his computer. Within a few moments, he had fallen asleep in his bathrobe, head slumped on the keyboard. But as Bob Morris tried to find out who had attacked the Internet, he would have no idea how close to home the source of the problem lay. A chance find in a Manhattan junk shop had led Bob Morris into the classified nerve center of America's computer defenses. 25 years after leaving Harvard, he wrote a message in the anniversary notebook for his class. "A long time ago," he wrote, "I promised myself that I would learn to read Greek, learn in some detail how the planets moved in their orbits, and how to decipher secret codes. I have gone a long way toward keeping all three promises." From the 1960s, he was working at Bell Labs at the leading edge of computer development. He had been part of the team that had designed the first modem, which could then move data at the rate of 48 bits per second, and was one of the first people to have a remote computer terminal in his home through which he could dial into the office. In the early 1960s, colleagues played a game called Darwin. They would design code which would be unleashed in a computer and fight the other person's code to the death. Morris came along and wrote a simple program that adapted to its opponent's behavior and wiped the field. Morris helped develop the Unix operating system for computers, and from the late 1960s, one of his tasks had been developing the process for encrypting passwords for it. This had got him interested in cryptography. Scouring a junk shop in New York around 1970, he came across a vintage Hagelin machine, similar in many ways to an Enigma. He transferred some of the techniques to Unix and also began looking at mathematical and statistical attacks to try to break it, similar to the kind of Bletchley maths of the war. Morris, along with Dennis Ritchie, a colleague at Bell Labs, and Jim Reeds, who had worked on a similar attack, planned to publish a paper outlining their methods in a journal. The three agreed they should probably talk to the NSA. Morris and Ritchie then received a visit from a man whom Morris called a retired gentleman from Virginia. "He was quite a charmer," recalled Dennis Ritchie. Over lunch, the man explained that the problem was that the method the three had discovered to attack the Hagelin machine was also applicable to systems still used by other governments, and so while there was nothing that could be done to stop publication, it might not be wise. There had been no explicit threat. That was not needed. "I suspect we all had the feeling that we'd shaken a velvet-gloved hand on friendly terms and sensed that there was steel underneath," Ritchie noted. But the man also made an offer. Their work had been good, but the work inside the NSA was better. Would they be interested in consulting? Then they could be privy to the highest level of research. This was the era when the NSA was fighting to hold on to its monopoly on encryption and still hoped to co-opt those on the outside. In the end, the paper was quietly shelved, and a few years later, Morris was not just consulting but working inside the NSA for the National Computer Security Center. The center had been set up as a result of the NSA's increasing use of commercially produced software. This meant there needed to be some mechanism for the spies and the outside world to talk about security issues and for the products to be vetted and certified as secure enough to be used for secret work. Roger Schell had been the driving force until he left in 1984. The NCSC did not have an easy time at the start. The communications security people in the NSA did not like talking, since their work was highly classified and they did not want anything leaking out to the new center's industry contacts. Meanwhile, industry was wary of any kind of security demands that might slow down its systems or raise costs. Now, in 1988, the center was watching the first internet crisis. The teams at the various universities and labs had worked out how to kill the virus, but the hunt was on for the perpetrator. TV news reports were talking colorfully of a dark genius behind the attack. On the 4th of November, 2 days after it all began, a reporter from the New York Times working on the story put a call into the NSA. Bob Morris called him back. The reporter had been talking to Cliff Stoll, who had worked out the likely computer username of the perpetrator and then what his actual name might be. The reporter could tell that Morris seemed to know a lot about what was going on, and so he tried out the name he had heard from Stoll. Morris confirmed the name was indeed correct. The reporter then noticed something odd. "It's a funny coincidence," the reporter said, almost as an aside. "You both have the same name." Without missing a beat, Morris replied, "That's no coincidence. He's my son." I had a feeling this kind of thing would come to an end the day he found out about girls, his father said later, deadpan. "Girls are more of a challenge." But not every child has his father bring home an Enigma machine from the office. The young Robert T. Morris had immersed himself in the world of computers his father had introduced him to. As a teenager, he was one of a couple of dozen children of the staff at Bell Labs who had been given their own computer accounts. They had begun communicating online with each other, forming perhaps the first teenage social network. Morris Jr. had enjoyed finding holes in computer security. When he was 16, he explained to a reporter, introduced to him by his father, how you could get into computer systems. The magazine described a quiet, polite young man with soft brown hair and rosy cheeks, who has broken into password files, read supposedly private computer mail, and has broken into computers that are linked together in networks. Morris Jr. even gave a lecture at the NSA on computer security, one part of which was entitled, How Not to Get Caught. He was a shy boy who loved reading computer manuals, but also enjoyed playing pranks on friends and colleagues. Morris Jr. had ended up first at Harvard and then at Cornell University's graduate school. In October 1988, he had started work on a worm, the term for a self-replicating piece of code which was first coined in an influential science fiction novel, The Shockwave Rider by John Brunner, published in 1975. From the early 1960s, hackers had developed rabbits, given the name no doubt because they bred rapidly and could bring a single computer to its knees by flooding it with commands. By the mid-1970s, as computers were being networked, the first worms designed to spread from machine to machine were being developed. At Xerox, they designed one, not as something destructive, but in order to move around a network looking for free space which could be used. In Brunner's book, the worm was a weapon. a totalitarian government exercised power through computers, and so the resistance released a tapeworm, which replicated itself to destroy the network. Was the Morris worm a Brunner weapon or a Xerox test? Perhaps the answer lies somewhere in between. It was made to copy itself from machine to machine through the internet, exploiting security flaws in Unix. A brute force dictionary attack exploited the fact that people used obvious passwords, something his father had specifically worked on. The worm actually did nothing other than spread from machine to machine, exploiting flaws. It did no damage in itself. It was an experiment to see how far something could spread. The younger Morris designed his worm so it would spread fast and be hard to detect and to kill. The worm was only removed when a computer was shut down, but that only happened properly once every week or two in those days. Morris understood that as it spread, the worm risked clogging up the system, so he took a precaution. Every time a worm spread to a machine, it would check whether there was already a worm present. If there was, there would be an electronic toss of a coin, and the worm that lost would commit suicide. However, Morris knew this was also a weakness. A clever person could spot this and fool the worm into thinking there was already a copy on the machine, leading it to kill itself. So he made another adjustment. A certain proportion of worms would be immortal worms, which would not be killed by a coin toss and would duplicate themselves even if there was another worm on a computer. Morris's catastrophic error, though, was over how many worms he would make immortal. He picked 1 in 7. And so, on the evening of the 7th of November, Morris went to MIT to hide his tracks, released his worm, and went off to dinner. A few hours later, he came back and noticed his machine was slow. Something had gone wrong. The 1 in 7 immortal worms were spreading so fast they were bringing computers to a grinding halt. Here was a crucial lesson about unleashing attacks over this new interconnected medium. However clever you thought you were, you could never be quite sure how far your code might travel and what exactly it might do. The law of unintended consequences acted with added force in cyberspace. Morris panicked. Within hours, he had contacted a friend at Harvard to discuss a solution. They sent an anonymous message instructing people how to kill the worm, but by then it was too late. The network was already clogged under the traffic, and the message did not get through for another 24 hours. Universities, medical research facilities, and the military found their machines crashing. Once they eventually worked out a fix to stop the spread, the tiny world of the internet began to calm down, but then the hunt had begun for the culprit. Morris Jr. knew there was no escape. Close to midnight on the evening after he had released his worm, Morris had called his father and told him what had happened. The next step was finding a lawyer. Within days, his name was on the front page of the New York Times, and the national media were camped out on the driveway while his mother fed him chicken soup inside. Bob Morris acknowledges that his son's behavior is not a career plus, but, ever the proud father, he also pointed out just how clever a program his son had written. Morris Sr. said the action would make people more aware of vulnerabilities, but others warned that imitators would adapt the code to make it even more dangerous. On the morning of Tuesday, the 8th of November, the internet was largely back up and the 50 experts involved in picking up the pieces gathered to meet with officials from the National Computer Security Center. It was clear that the worm had only been stopped thanks to an informal network of people who knew each other and were able to swap notes quickly in an emergency. Everyone knew this was not going to be sustainable as the internet grew. There needed to be something more formal to deal with any future crisis. This led to the creation of the Computer Emergency Response Team, or CERT, a group to firefight any crisis. Today, almost every country has a CERT. This was not the first virus or worm ever to spread, and it would not be the last. Others like Michelangelo and Conficker had significant impact on the way people saw computer security, but the Morris worm was the first to make the national news because of the havoc it caused, and the first to make the wider world, and not just the small community of computer experts, understand the potential vulnerabilities. Computers were vulnerable, but so was the Internet itself. The worm, unleashed by Bob Morris's son, caused shockwaves inside his father's agency, the NSA, as well as Britain's GCHQ, where experts realized they had not been paying sufficient attention. From the early 1980s, they had been aware of computer hackers developing viruses to spread on early personal computers like the Apple II and first IBM PCs. An internal top-secret NSA paper in late 1985 had outlined the possibility of something malicious self-propagating through viral infection, or another problem called denial of service, in which the computer's processing power would be used up by a virus so that it could not perform other functions. But until the Morris worm, this was all theoretical and nothing to do with the secret agencies, partly because they were not connected to networks and so could not grasp the damage that could be wreaked through them. That was the real wake-up call. I remember hearing about it and essentially understanding what happened and saying, "Wow, we have missed it in terms of being something we really need to be paying attention to," one official later reflected. From the mid-1980s, computer viruses began proliferating. Many were designed to show off or send a message, like the Peace Virus, which popped up a message calling for universal peace to all Macintosh users. The following year saw the Worms Against Nuclear Killers Virus. The joke was in the name. There were the first signs of real-world consequences as well, though. Two hospitals reported virus infections in 1989, which affected image displays for cardiac studies and patient diagnosis. Companies began offering virus scanning products, and then hackers started to hide their work better and even pose as virus scanning companies to get people to download infected products. The NSA had its first experience of a hacker in 1986 with a string of incidents involving DocMaster, a system which could be accessed externally via dial-in modems with the right password and user ID. In October, someone noticed that his login was already active as he entered the system. A Trojan horse had been used to grab user passwords and then dial in. Soon after, another user noticed that details about when he had last logged in were wrong. An intruder had been in the system for 2 hours and 14 minutes over several days, potentially allowing them to grab over 2 billion bytes of information. Earlier that year, one of America's most notorious hackers seems to have been the culprit in another intrusion. Kevin Mitnick's forte was employing a mix of technical knowledge and social engineering, meaning manipulating people to get them to help you. This might involve learning the jargon and structures of a particular organization so that when he called someone up and said he was an in-house engineer who needed help, he would sound as convincing as possible, techniques which are the forerunners of modern, highly targeted email attacks. He phoned a guest user of DocMaster at the NSA and claimed he was from the NSA and was issuing new passwords. He asked if he could please get the name of the user's old password. Mitnick's hacking had grown out of phone phreaking in the early 1970s, in which people worked out that you could imitate the sounds that controlled the electromechanical telephone switches to get yourself free calls. A hacker called Captain Crunch took his name from a type of cereal after he discovered that a free whistle found in the bottom of the packet was exactly the right tone to control an AT&T telephone switch. Stephen Wozniak got to know Captain Crunch, and soon he and a friend, Stephen Jobs, began building boxes to do the same thing, offering them to students, part of a community of people who mixed computer hacking with phone phreaking and building their own hardware. Wozniak and Jobs decided to build a basic, low-cost computer they could sell to a burgeoning subculture of people like them. And so the two started a company called Apple in the late 1970s, imbued with the hacker ethic. Computers were beginning to get personal. Computers were also taking over the telephone switching process as telecoms companies began moving towards fully electronic exchanges to connect up calls. This was the next stage of telecommunications and computers merging, a process still underway. For hackers like Mitnick, the challenge was getting into the computers that controlled phone lines. Mitnick wrote his own program to steal people's passwords by creating a fake login page on their computer. His motive was not to destroy, but to poke fun, to embarrass, to reveal lapses, and in so doing, show his own superiority. The thrill of attacking a tougher target was, Mitnick says, like getting to the higher level of a video game. He began sharing tips and tricks, tools and weaknesses with a community of other hackers during the 1980s, developing tricks like routing his access through other countries, including the UK, to keep law enforcement off his back. At times, the mythology surrounding him exceeded the truth. A Time magazine article claimed that putting a phone in Mitnick's hands is like giving a gun to a hitman. And one federal prosecutor said of Mitnick to a judge, he can whistle into a telephone and launch a nuclear missile from NORAD. It was a claim clearly designed to play into the fears arising from the movie War Games, but was also patently untrue and indicative of a lack of understanding. An older generation were realizing that a group of dropout kids knew more about the technology that made society tick than they did. Hacking was moving from a quirky subculture into the wider realms of social fear and becoming criminalized. Robert Morris Jr. was the first person to be caught and prosecuted, his motives never being entirely clear. In the late 1980s, there had been a lot of debate within the computer community about how hard he should be punished. Some felt it was vital to be tough to establish deterrence, or else others might follow suit. But one of the problems was trying to work out what damage he had actually caused. Some said it was nearly $100 million, and yet, within a few hours, systems had been patched and nothing had been destroyed, so others said the damage had been close to zero. This pointed to a problem that remains today when it comes to breaches in cybersecurity. How do you calculate the damage? Morris became the first person convicted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, receiving 3 years probation, a $10,000 fine, and 400 hours of community service. He went on to earn his PhD and become a serious and respected computer scientist and inventor, putting his past well behind him. If he had not done it, someone else would have done, but Morris was the first to reveal what chaos could be wreaked over computer networks. Robert Morris's father gave the occasional talk on what was then called computer security after he retired from the NSA. He would enjoy explaining a truth that his years of technical understanding had brought. "There are three golden rules to ensure computer security," he would say. "They are, do not own a computer, do not power it on, and do not use it." He had learnt the hard way. His son's worm had highlighted a number of key lessons, the ability to exploit vulnerabilities, both within programs and also of humans, for instance, weak passwords, and to do so remotely, the ability of viruses and worms to propagate rapidly, but also in ways even the author might not be able to predict, and the ability to wreak significant harm by bringing a system juddering to a halt. There was a final lesson reflected in his golden rules. Computers were inherently insecure. The internet had come under attack, but from one of its own, and from within the tight confines of America's computer community. That same year, there were also darker signs, signs that other countries might be able to exploit computers to spy on America. Cliff Stoll, the astronomer-cum-amateur computer sleuth who had called Bob Morris early that November morning to tell him there was something wrong, wrote a report on the impact of the Morris worm. Thousands of miles away, soon afterwards, a young man handed over a copy of that report to the KGB.